ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last. I'm happy to be with you once again as we go and sit down and listen to wrestling's greatest storyteller, the Tennessee Stud, as he talks all about his career and his life in and around professional wrestling. Without any further ado, the man himself, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Ron, here we are again. I've said it in the past that there's a topic of yours that you love and that the listeners really react to that they love, and that's the Bahamas. And here we are once again.
Yes, I guess the reason for it is, I mean, obviously, our patrons have heard the entire story and then some. Actually, we leave in the Caribbean Chaos, the third Super Studcast. We actually go beyond just the Bahamas and we go to Puerto Rico and we cover some flights and private planes and we cover a whole lot of things. But there's so many people that are listening to the Studcast who have not yet listened to a Super Studcast. And I feel like, you know, a couple of weeks ago, in episode, I think it was 44, we touched on a little bit of the Bahamas. And gosh, the comments were just fabulous. And people were like, wow, what? Give us more, give us more. And so today, I think we're going to revisit. We're going to go back and revisit the Bahamas. And I think a good way to start it, Brian, is maybe me to go back. You know, I, as a storyteller, and I love to tell stories. It's kind of like painting a picture. You can't hardly tell a great story if you leave out some of the colors and you don't cover all the background. So, in order to continue with the story, I want to back up for those people that have never heard any of this Bahamas stuff. Because it's so unique. It's a great topic. I love talking about the wrestling there because it's unlike any place else on earth. So I want to go back very quickly for those that may not. And a real quick recap for those that have. It won't last long, but I want to talk a little bit about the design of the stadium. It's about twice the size of a basketball court. It has a 10-foot concrete wall. Made out of concrete blocks that go around the perimeter, the entire outside of the facility. It's got people that throw rocks, and not just throw rocks from inside the arena. They throw rocks from outside the arena. A lot of it is because they can't afford or they can't get in to the arena. So they decide that they're going to bombard you all night long. Sometimes it's an occasional big rock or a small rock comes over the wall and someone in the crowd gets it or it hits on the concrete out there somewhere and nobody gets hit. But it's a very intimidating atmosphere to wrestle in because you never know what's going to happen during the course of the match. It's that same place that has those fans that do things that I've never heard anywhere, and I've wrestled pretty much all over the world. They've got that bis boom ba going all the time when you're making a comeback on somebody. Every punch has a sound to it, and it's like almost somebody's holding up a big card out there like they do in the audiences, you know, about cheer now or whatever, and they go bist, and the next card is boom, and the next card is bah. You know, you get these sound effects from the crowd, which is it's really a different atmosphere than any place that I've ever wrestled or that most any other guys that have been there wrestle. At the same time, you've got the wall there. The wall prohibits those that don't have the money to come in from getting into the arena. And they come up with the ingenious idea here of just tossing each other over the wall, basically. You put your feet in their hands, and they just shoot these people over this 10-foot wall. And sometimes they land on their heads. Sometimes they land on their face. Sometimes they land on their backs. Sometimes they land on people. It's crazy. The guy that runs the facility has a pool hall in the front of it that you enter and pay your fee to get into the matches, to get your ticket. You buy a ticket inside the pool hall, and then you enter into Nassau Stadium, it's called. And he has his cutoff pool cue that's filled with lead. And when people come flying over that wall, the first one I saw come flying over the wall, this guy smacks him upside the head with that pool cue. It's like, wow, what in the world is going on here? You just don't see that anywhere else in the world. It's a extremely dangerous place for heels. Heels don't win matches there, and if they do, they're in jeopardy of their lives. So it's a very, very hard place to work as a heel, and you don't see heat. You don't see the type of heat that you see in normal Florida matches because you can't do it. If you generate that, you're going to have the riot. You're going to have the riots. You're going to get somebody hurt. So that's something that you don't see. Riots, I've been in plenty of them. But you don't want to get in one in a country like that in which your police are just as big of fans as the fans themselves, and they're not there to protect the heel. They're there, in some cases, to be part of the crowd, and then they'll join in the ride, and they'll be on the sides of the fans rather than your heel. And that's a deadly situation when you have that. And then there was, after this first time that I go there, and I've already talked about once, I start complaining to Lester. I don't know why people hadn't complained to Lester before, but I start complaining to Lester. So I think that's kind of painting a background for where we're headed here. And just to go right along with what I've just said, I have just witnessed the first time there, the guys come flying over the wall. This whole atmosphere that I've just spoken about. And I asked Lester on the flight back from Nassau to Tampa about, you know, what's this all about? Why can't you fix the wall? You know, I just focused on the wall because that's where people were getting in for free. You weren't getting a very good payoff there. And you wrestle in that atmosphere. It's hot and it's humid as and if it's raining, you wrestle in the rain. The dressing rooms are so hot and so dirty that you can't stand to be in the dressing room. So you stand out and the crowd just drives you crazy. It's just a terrible place to work. So I asked Lester, you know, what can you do about that wall? And he says, Ron, you know, I'm going to think about that a little bit. So I'm going to talk now about my second trip back to Nassau. And this particular night, I'm going to have a 6-man tag, and it's going to be the first and only time I'm going to wrestle with Lester's sons, who are my cousins, obviously, part of the Welch family, Jack and Roy Lee. And it's a great it's a great event for me. It's an opportunity for me to be side by side with Welch's, the three of us in the corner. I wish I'd had a photo of that, but I do have a photo of my cousins, Jack and Roy. I'm going to put that on my gallery, and that'll be one that people that go to look for this studcast, they're going to see their photos. These guys are great workers. They're great young workers. They're smaller than I am because Lester is smaller than my dad. I assume I'm going to contribute it to that. They're shorter. Body size, we're fairly similar. I may be a little bigger in the body, and I'm certainly probably 5-6 inches taller than each of them. So we're working with J.C. Dykes and his Infernos. Great team. The Infernos are, one is named Rocky Smith and his brother at this time. Now, Rocky had other partners, and I don't remember exactly who his other partners were with the Infernos, but later on in his career, his brother named Curtis became one of the Infernos with Rocky. And Rocky was the cornerstone. He was the man that made it happen in the ring, had great timing, and a tremendous worker. J.C. Dykes is a red-haired, little pipsqueak type of manager who got great heat. And in this particular match, it's the six of us in the ring together. We're all in there, and J.C. has actually got trunks on, and he is involved in the tag itself. So it's kind of an unusual event, makes it unique to me. You don't see J.C. being in many of these. Their gimmick is, especially Rocky, he's the guy that does the damage in the matches, is he loads his boot. It's the old gimmick of patting the old foot on his toe down like he's a piece of metal that's sliding into the toe of his boot. And they win predominantly all their matches with this one move. Well, we're in the Bahamas, and obviously he's not going to be loading the boot tonight because he's not wanting to get killed. You know, they're not going over. They're going to lose, and they're going to lose probably pretty handily, too, because they're concerned about just having to go out there and do what they have to do. I think heels should make more money than baby faces for that reason alone, that sometimes you put your life in jeopardy to go out there and do what you do as a heel. A baby face is going to get patted on the back, and the heel is going to get a knife stuck in his back if he's not careful. So it's a whole different ball game. So that's kind of where we are. We've gone there. We're in Nassau Stadium. We wrestled that night. But what I noticed and what everybody else in the crew notices is when we walked through that night into this inside of the stadium, that Lester has done his homework. He has gone and designed something that when you look at it, it's pretty scary. It's a barbed wire fence that is in giant rolls. It's kind of like what you see on the top of fences in a prison, or I call it the Siegfried line, like you see in World War I, in which they just made these giant round continual rolls of barbed wire that you couldn't climb over and you couldn't climb through and that type of thing. So what he's done is he has steel poles mounted in the top of the wall about every 6 feet, and he connects this wire to that entire thing for the entire distance of the stadium. So it now has this bundle of probably 3 to 4 feet high barbed wire that is connected to the top of the wall that goes around the entire exterior of Nassau Stadium. I remember when I first looked up at it and saw it, I was like, wow, that looks horrible. I could not imagine anybody ever getting over that or into the arena from the outside anymore. And I think I probably went and congratulated Lester about, geez, man, that's a great job you've done here. So it looks like he solved the wall problem. And so we're all kind of congratulating each other like, wow, this is a really cool deal, man. You know, we don't have to worry about somebody going from flying over the wall and landing on top of us. We don't have to worry about the crowd doubling in size after the bell when they start tossing people into the arena for free. It seems to solve the problem. But going to find out here pretty quickly it doesn't.
Well, we're going to find out here pretty quickly. You set it up already. It's so easy for you to laugh about all of this years later. At the time when you have to go back there, are you laughing in the moment? Are you able to take it in and see the humor in all of this? Or are you thinking, oh, I really don't want to go back here?
Oh, I tell you, when you get used to, in the old days, there was a guy named Charlie Lay that was at the front door of the office in 106 North Albany, the Tampa office. He had your bookings for the entire week, and they usually printed them out on a piece of paper for you. You went down to the office on a Monday, as an example, and you would say, Charlie, where am I this week? And he would pass you your sheet. And I remember having a lot of chuckles about it. If there was two or three of us went to get our sheet at the same time, you would know who got the Bahamas and who didn't. You could tell by the reaction of the guys when they read their sheet, because you got down to Saturday and you saw the Bahamas on your sheet. You were like, oh, the heads would drop. I mean, guys hated it. You just didn't want to go there, and you weren't going to get a good payoff. You were going to have to put up with all these potential dangers, and it just was not a good situation. Guys did not want to go.
Did you think when you saw what Lester had done to the stadium that it was because of the conversation you had with him, or had it been something in the works for a while?
I think it was because of the conversation. And Lester's a funny guy. Lester's a very quiet person, and he does not he does not communicate with people well. I think I mentioned, he had his own plane, and he would fly his plane 7 hours from Fort Lauderdale to San Juan, Puerto Rico. He wouldn't say a single word. He wouldn't talk to anybody. If you had a problem, you had to beg for him to tell you what's going on here, what the problem is. So I think, you know, my going and talking to him kind of pushed him a little bit to say, well, you know, maybe I do need to do something here. You know, I don't know how long they had been running the Bahamas prior to my going there, but the first time there, I was like, wow, how can you do business like this? You got to try to stop this. So I think he might have done this because of my suggestion, or maybe some other people started complaining, and they had been complaining for a while, and he might have been thinking, what can I do? And so this particular night, when I look at it, I think he maybe has the answer to the problem.
Well, you set it up now twice. Everyone's dying to know what exactly happened that night.
Okay. Now, this is the part I love. This is the part that shows you how badly some people want to see wrestling, that they would do almost anything to be able to see it. In a country like that, that's very poor, they don't have the money to see it. So they're even pushed further to do something really, really off the wall, as a pun here. I noticed that about the time, maybe 30 minutes before match time, I see a couple of guys that have been boosted up on top of the wall, and they have their feet underneath the barbed wire, and they run their arms into the wire, you know, and where it's not cutting them, but they have a way to hold on to the wire. And now they're standing on top of the wall and getting the matches for free again. It's like they've figured out how to beat this system. And it's like, I was like, I think I went and got Jack and Roy, and I said, check this out, man. Look at this. And by the time that started, they just started lining up. They started shoving them up on top of the wall. Once they got their feet up there, they were shoulder to shoulder. And that line started growing down one side of the wall. It went across the back part of the stadium, the other side of the stadium's wall. It was like within time the matches start, there must be 300 guys standing on this wall holding the barbed wire. I'm like, whoa, my goodness, man. It looked to me like it was worse than ever. I mean, it's now you've provided them a way to be able to see it without even taking the bump on the concrete when they get tossed over. So I'm like, really? Wow, this is terrible. So we go through halfway through the night, halfway through the card, and those guys that are on top of the wall, they're just like the fans in the stadium down below. They're bits booming and bawing. There's a match going on or whatever, and all of a sudden, down at one end of the wall, on the side of the complex, on the side of the stadium, the pole, the metal pole that the wire is fixed to, it breaks off. And when it does, it starts, the people on the wall, they've got their hands and they're all hooked and connected into the wire. They can't grab and jerk their hands out of there quickly, jump off the wall to save themselves. They're all tied into that wire, and that wire starts falling off that stadium. And I'm lucky enough to be watching it. I got to see it. It started on one side of the stadium. It looked like dominoes going down, except they were going off backwards, and you could tell they couldn't stop themselves. They couldn't help the bump they were about to take. They couldn't reach back. They couldn't do anything to protect themselves. And they land on that hard coral out there behind the stadium. You can hear the breath being forced out of their bodies from the concussion of that bump. And then the dirt starts coming up. And a little bit of smoke comes up. And that entire stadium, it starts at one end. It probably takes as much as 2 minutes for it to all disappear. And when it's all disappeared, every one of those bodies has landed on their back out there on the ground. And it was like, and when it was half done, I was already laughing like, wow, I'll never see this again. This has never, ever happened in the history of wrestling or maybe any sport. I mean, there's nothing ever like this ever happened. And it just was phenomenal to stand there and watch that wall of humans disappear a little at a time. It was just spectacular.
What does Lester say about it afterwards?
Well, you know, he's like, he's very, very upset. I mean, he spent a lot of time. They spent a lot of effort. And he really thought, as I did when I first saw this idea, that he'd done it, that this was it. And there'll never be a problem about this again, that I've got the solution to it. And then when he sees all that and all of his effort and all of his time, and then what makes it worse is when this happens, and it happens about halfway through the night, those guys that were on the wall, now they're pissed. They're mad. You know, they're mad. They've taken this horrible bump on their backs out there. They're dirty. They're just, and so the rocks that normally come are tenfold all of a sudden. You know, now they're just going to bombard the stadium with rocks. It's just like a meteorite shower. The fans are ringsiders, same as always. They're accustomed to it. They take their chairs, they put them over their heads, and they catch the rocks on the bottoms of their chairs rather than on their heads. And it just continues. It probably continued, I'd say, for one 5 minute stretch. They must have thrown 3,000 rocks over the wall. You couldn't hardly walk in the stadium for the rocks that were laying there. So now it's even more dangerous. It's added to the danger that was already there. And it's just now, I remember talking to Lester about it then. You know, I said, God, Lester, I mean, it looked good. I think you had the right idea, and I'm sure you thought you had the right idea. Never expected that to happen. And he says, yeah, I know. He's kind of low-key. I know, Ron. I say, what are you going to do next? You know, and he had no idea at that point. He had no idea. So that's kind of what happens on that particular night. And it's a continuing saga in the Bahamas. Every time you go, if it's not one thing, it's about two or three other things that make it a horrible place to be.
For those who never got to see Roy Lee or Jackie Welch wrestle, how would you compare them to you or your brother or Jimmy?
I would say on their behalf, they did not have a long career like Rob and Jimmy and I had. They're good wrestlers. Lester, I assume, taught them And I don't know if he didn't. My dad didn't teach Rob and I, so maybe Lester had someone else that taught them to work. But they were good workers. They were not big in size, stature, and that hurt them in the respect that it was harder for them to get over. They weren't used quite like I'm being used in 1971 as a new guy, and within the first year, pretty darn good, because I have the height, which really makes me kind of different than everybody else. That 6'9" height, that really makes you different, and you stand out literally in more ways than one. But they're smaller. They don't wrestle. I don't think their careers probably last more. Roy Lee wrestles on into Continental days with me. He wrestles for me in Southeastern, and he wrestles in Southeastern when we go to Pensacola, when it changes to Continental. Roy is on and off, but he's not a steady wrestler. We use him when we need him, and Jack's career is much shorter than that. I'd say Jack probably lasts 4 or 5 years. Rob, Jimmy, and I, it's like anything else. When you're an athlete, the more you do it, the better at it you get. And we were in it for so long, and not just in it, but we were able to work on every night. And when you do that, you're going to become pretty darn good at whatever it is that you do. And then you got a lot of possibilities, and you're going to get a lot of bookings. And that kind of what happened for us. Our careers expanded far beyond the two of them.
Besides your father, you, Rob, or Jimmy, when it comes to your extended family, the Welches, the Fields, your entire, I guess I could say the Goldens too, the entire extended family, who would you say was the best worker outside of you four?
I'm going to say probably Herb, Roy's brother. He was the first one taught. Roy taught him. Roy started, obviously, in 24, and then he taught Herb to wrestle. Herb went on to be a great wrestler, had a good body, very good body. He was about 6'2". Now, back in the 30s, that's a pretty good-sized guy, 6'2", 220 pounds. He was a pretty much a hoss of a man back in those days. People were smaller than what they are nowadays. He also had a great feel for the sport. He became the world. You know how they have the certain areas of the country started having their own world junior champions. There wasn't a recognizable world champion in the junior classification, but in the early days, in Herb's day, they did have one, and Herb was the world junior heavyweight champion for almost 5 years undefeated, and had a car wreck and lost the title because he couldn't defend it. And I think he went back after he got over the car wreck, and he felt he got his health back, and he was able to work again. I think he won it back again for a short period of time. So I think probably Herb was maybe the best, other than the group of the four of us. The Fields brothers were great wrestlers. Their daddy had gotten them involved real early. They all lived in Dyersburg, Tennessee, the town that Rob and I was born in. I think Jimmy was probably born in Dyersburg as well. And that's where Roy had his office, in way back in the 40s and the 50s, in that small town just north of Memphis. And the Fields boys were living there too. And that helped all of those Welches back that were young in those days. You had Herb to work out with. You had Roy to work out with. There was another Jack. They had a brother. Herb and Roy have a brother named Jack. And he works for a few years. He's not nearly the worker that Roy and Herb are. But you've got those older, that older generation to help train you and to work out with you. And it really helped that second generation. That's my father. That's Lester is actually part of the Roy's brother rather than my dad's, but he's about my dad's age. So you've got those Fields brothers and Lester and Dad. All of those are young guys that are starting out with Herb and Roy as their benchmarks, as their idols, their icons. That's who they look up to. And that helped them tremendously to be great workers. And the three Fields brothers were very, very good workers.
What about Ricky Fields? He ended up working for you after you bought Gulf Coast, correct?
Yes, he did. And Ricky was the difference in the Fields brothers and the Welches is height. And both Lee, Bobby, and Don were the three Fields brothers. They were all under 6 feet, and I don't know exactly what their height was exactly. They had pretty substantial bodies, but they weren't muscular. They weren't extremely muscular. And so when you're 5'10 and you weigh 190 pounds, it's going to be really hard for you to become a big star because you just don't have the stature for it in the body. But those guys were great workers, phenomenal workers. And once they bought that Gulf Coast Wrestling from my father in 1958, and we went to Memphis, they did great business there for many, many years in that Gulf Coast area. And they were the top babies that for probably 10 years there and did super business.
We will return with more Bahama Bedlam after these words.
Next week's Studcast is a very special one. The 52nd episode makes it the final Studcast in the first year. It's not only special to the stud, but he wants this one to be special for all the fans that have made his Studcast such a huge success. We're going on a very special ride into all six Super Studcasts. The stud has personally selected fantastic segments from each that thousands of listeners have never heard from wrestling's greatest storyteller. You'll experience Andre the Giant, Rowdy Ron Wright, the Crazy Caribbean, his brother Robert Fuller, Hall of Famer Bob Armstrong, and the outrageous Japan Tour of 1983. Then, on Tuesday, July 17th, he does it again with the next fabulous Super Studcast. For the first time ever, the stud will follow the Japan Super Studcast with not one, but two live guests from that show. In the first hour of Super Studcast number 7, he and Brian will talk to one of the all-time great big men in the sport, Stan the Lariat Hansen. The second hour will be Stan's friend and trainer. This wrestler will be the first former NWA World Champion to do a Studcast, and one of the most wild and crazy champions ever, Terry Funk. Obviously, in the second year, Studcast and Super Studcast are taking a quantum leap forward as your Tennessee stud strives to blow fans away and continue his quest for podcast history.
There you hear it. Two really big announcements here this week on the Studcast. Of course, the first anniversary show coming up, as well as Super Studcast number 7, both huge shows. We'll have more information about them later on in the program, but let's return to Nassau. Let's return to the Bahamas, Ron. Let's return to you and Lester.
All right. Yes, we've had the conversation now, Lester and I, I commend him in a way, hey, look, I thought you had it. I mean, the Siegfried Wall looked good. I didn't know what to call it. The Siegfried Line, whatever you call it. That seemed like a great idea, Lester, but it didn't get it done, and it made kind of things worse a little bit because of all those guys that took that big bump, and now they're wanting to get even, and so they chunk a lot more rocks than usual, and it's more dangerous in the facility than it ever was. And so he gets the picture with me again. I don't know whether he's doing this stuff for me or whether other people are saying things to him as well, but he says, Ron, well, let's see what happens. So next time we go back, I go in there and I see that he has really solved the problem. When we walk into the stadium, I'd never seen anything done like this before, and it was a scary sight. What they had done is he had found bottles, old drink bottles or whatever, and I don't even know how they did this. It looked like somebody had taken a drink bottle that was solid, and a rock had a rock there, and just took the top part and broke it off, and left jagged edges sticking straight up out of the Coke bottle. And all those Coke bottles, anywhere from 2 inches high up to 6 inches high, but the tops of them are all the shards of sharp glass. And then they cemented all of those into the top of that wall, all the way around the exterior of the stadium. I remember when we walked in, I don't remember who was on that card the night that we went back, the next time that we go back, but I was just like astounded. It's like, whoa, my gosh almighty. I mean, you couldn't throw somebody. You couldn't help somebody stand on the wall anymore because obviously there's glass up there, and that glass is just going to it's going to ruin you. You couldn't toss somebody over because if you didn't get them all the way over the wall and they come down on that glass, they're just going to be they're going to have more holes than Swiss cheese, and they're just going to be bloody as can possibly be. So to me, it's like, wow, this is just fabulous. Lester, you have killed any chance that these people are going to be able to get over that wall anymore. And that night, we didn't have, as I remember, we didn't have a single person that I saw get in that building that didn't buy a ticket. And that made us all feel a little bit better about what was going on and what was going to happen for the future of the town.
Certainly less exciting, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to see the entertainment. We're not going to be watching the wall or watching some other area to see what's going to happen from the crowd. We're being entertained by the crowd there as much as we are entertaining them. You know, I'm watching the crowd as much as the matches, because it's, you never know what you're going to see and you never know what's going to happen. So yeah, that part of it, that part of the attraction there is pretty much over. Except, you know, as we get down the road here a little bit, I may want to come back and talk more about one more program, maybe about the Bahamas, and discuss what else happens. This is a teaser here. What's left here is you've got on one side of the facility now, you have a huge oak tree. I mean, it's one of the biggest oak trees I've ever seen. And you don't have a lot of oak trees in the Bahamas. It's a tropical place, and you've got all kinds of different palms and things like that. You see a whole lot of those, but you rarely see an oak tree in the Bahamas. So on one side of the stadium, there's this giant oak tree. And I mean by giant, it's got to be 200 feet, I would think. He's just monstrous. I don't think four people could lock their arms and reach around it. The trunk is just massive. And on the opposite side of the stadium, there's a garage. It's either a workshop or a garage. It doesn't seem to be a house attached to it, but it's a structure there that's probably, I'm going to say 25 feet by 25 feet, maybe. And it's probably 15 feet tall, and it has a regular roof on, a pitched roof on it. And that are the only structures that are exterior to the stadium in which fans could somehow manipulate a place to be able to watch the matches from. And I think that's probably where we go next time.
Well, there's always something, and it gets crazier and crazier. And like you said, it is certainly a topic we will return to in the future. But last week on the show, we had I hate to say we had a good time talking about cauliflower ears, but I guess we did. And we ran long, and we did not have any questions from the listeners. Let's solve that this week by having an extra question, and let's get the first one in right now. It's from Todd Flynn in, and you're going to have to help me here, Ron, is it Sevierville, Tennessee?
Sevierville, Tennessee. That's the home of Dolly Parton. Sevierville, Tennessee. It's right there in the Smoky Mountains, in the edge of the Smoky Mountains, and just east of the park of the Smoky Mountains National Park, which is the most visited national park in America. And she has her little Dollywood there. She's got her own little Six Flags. I mean, she's got a tremendous little operation going there in Sevierville. There's Sevierville and Pigeon Forge. Our little Dollywood is in Pigeon Forge. But I'm very familiar with that area up there. It's just maybe 30 miles west of Knoxville, right in the edge of the Smoky Mountains.
Todd's question: if David Schultz had worked for you during the slap incident with John Stossel for Vince McMahon Jr., how would you have handled that as his boss? After reading David's book, it sounds like he had a lot of respect for you.
Geez, that's a really good question. First of all, I haven't read David's book. I kind of hate to say that. You know, I haven't read David's book, but a little history of David for people that may not know David Schultz, and they remember, I'm sure, a lot of people remember him from WWF days. This is prior to it being WWE. David was trained by, of all people, we just talked about him a minute ago, Herb. David was trained by Herb. Herb trained David Schultz. He trained Wayne Ferris, who becomes the Honky Tonk Man. He trained Coco Beware. He trained several guys that go on to be big stars. And David Schultz, maybe before I answer this, I lay a little foundation here. David Schultz is a tough son of a gun. David Schultz is he's a crazy. He's crazy, but he's tough along with it. So, and I have experiences with David. He works for me. He comes to work for me in Knoxville in the late 70s. I take him into Pensacola down there when I do Southeastern out of Pensacola in 78. He's on that first crew that we set up and go down there with to turn that territory around. We do it in 3 months' time, which is an amazing thing because business was really, really bad. Things were terrible there, and I guess that's why they were looking to sell it. And some people said, you'll never build that territory. You'll never make it make money again. And I took a great crew down there. David is one of those guys. David and I get into a riot in Panama City. It's the worst riot I've ever been in, the only riot I ever got cut with a knife, got hit in the head with a chair. He's a strange guy, and he's been trained by not just one of the great shooters of all time. Herb is from that early phase in professional wrestling back in the 20s. He started in the late 20s and goes, he wrestles up into the 70s. He wrestles for 50 years just about, and he is all shoot. I mean, back in those days, most wrestlers were shooters. You didn't get to be a wrestler without being a shooter. It's quite different than the scenario that is in place now, in which very few of them have any shooting knowledge. They don't know how to wrestle. They don't know much at all about wrestling. So David learns from one of the very best shooters. He also learns, rather than just working, he learns how to shoot some from Herb. But what he really learns and what he takes away is this protective thing that wrestlers had back in those days. The further back you go, the more stringent they were about what you say about wrestling. You don't open your mouth to Roy or Herb or guys from back in the 20s and 30s and to say anything derogatory about wrestling. And I think now, having laid that foundation, I think that's what happens here. John Stossel is there to do a program. He's basing his questions around having very little knowledge about what pro wrestling is probably all about. He has just seen Vince's stuff. Now, you know, had he been in a different part of the country and had he experienced a different style and a different way of running business back in those days, he might have had a little more respect for the business than what he had. But I don't remember. I do remember seeing this slap, but I did not see it live. I wasn't watching the show when it happened. It's back, I believe, when they were doing live shows, maybe first NBC shows. I think they were on NBC for a short period of time, like on a Saturday night. And I think this may be, am I correct about that? Was this a time frame in which they were on Saturday night?
It's a little bit before that. This was filmed in the end of 1984, and it aired in early 1985 on 2020 on ABC. It was a special that John Stossel put together trying to prove that wrestling was fake while wrestling was starting to get very popular, at least in the eyes of the mainstream media. They interviewed Eddie Mansfield, who bladed on camera. They interviewed Jim Wilson, who talked about some of the underbelly of wrestling as he saw it. And then they interviewed Vince McMahon a little bit. And then they asked some of the wrestlers if wrestling was fake. And they didn't just say, you know, excuse me, Dr. D, is wrestling fake? It was very obnoxious. It was, I think it's fake. And then David showed him that he was trained by Herb Welch.
There you go. I mean, David did what he was trained to do. He stood up for the business. And as I remember in watching it back, he whacked him pretty good. I mean, he got his attention big time, and he would have taken it to the next level. I've seen Schultz. I've seen him operate, and I know he had that Herb attitude, and he would have liked nothing better than to have Stossel have some comeback. You know, I'm going to do this to you or whatever. It would have gotten very much more out of hand than just that slap. But I guess the question here is, how would I have handled that? One thing I think I would have done had I been Vince is I would have put somebody on Stossel's butt from the time he walked into the door until he left there to make sure that that didn't happen to him. Because Schultz wasn't the only one in that crew back in those days that came from a different atmosphere and came from a different training than where that WWE and WWF stuff was where it was headed. So I think if he had have said, you know, who do you want to talk to, John? And look, so-and-so here, Gerald Briscoe or somebody like Jerry Briscoe would have said, you know, come on, John, now who you want to see? And when John says, well, I want to talk to David Schultz about this, I think Jerry would have gone, no, let's talk to somebody else. Right? You need to ask this of somebody else. Because David, I don't think, you know, David wasn't prepared. I doubt he was prepared to get that blunt of a question and in that manner, and it just hit him the wrong way, and he reacted quicker than I'm sure he intended to react, and it was horrible for David. He lost his job. That's terrible. I mean, he had worked his way to a big company. He'd worked his way into a good spot. And right there, bam, his career with that company was over. And I don't think it's David's fault, maybe, as much as Vince's fault for not getting somebody to watch Stossel and make sure that Stossel, since this is his whole thing, I don't understand, to be quite honest with you, now I'm thinking about it here, Brian, why the hell did Vince allow him to come there and do that to begin with?
Obviously, you look in that room and you see Fuji's there. You see the Iron Sheik's there. So there's some guys there not to be messed with. And they're all around when Schultz does this. I don't know. But they let him in and they certainly sent him to the right guy if they wanted to send a message out.
Yeah, they certainly
and remember,
did.
Stossel didn't sue David Schultz. Stossel sued Vince McMahon.
Yeah, because David didn't have any money. David wasn't rich. Vince had a little more bread to deal with and a little more to be gained by suing somebody. David, I don't believe he would have got a whole lot of money out of David at that point. But, you know, bad incident. But my first impression when I saw this is wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I almost wished I'd had the opportunity of slapping myself. It's like, hey, you can't allow a guy to do that. I mean, you just, and then the old wrestlers back in the day, the old school guys, you had to really, really watch your mouth. You had to watch what you say, and you had to, if you had no respect, oh, you weren't going to get any, and you were maybe going to get your ass whipped rather than being respected. You would be totally disrespected and just having your ass stomped in the ground.
Our next question is from Barbara Manning in Chicago, Illinois. If you had been approached by John Stossel and asked the same question that David Schultz was asked, what would you have done?
Oh, boy, another good one. This is the same. It's wonderful. It's two questions, but it's totally different in a way. You know, I mean, there's David's reaction, which it's his personal thing. But I would have handled it different. I had my own. I think a lot of wrestlers have their own style of answering the question: is it real or not? And I got mine kind of back from growing up as a kid and my dad teaching me to shoot a little bit. And then when guys came to our house or to our farms or wherever it was, and they had a bad attitude and they wanted to wrestle a wrestler, and he would always say, well, you beat this skinny kid here first and then I'll wrestle you. And so he would give me the job of seeing whether they were tough or not. And I never had anyone that I didn't beat. I never had one, thank goodness, ever get the best of me. But I kind of got young man, I'm not in the ring at this point, I gained a lot of confidence that I knew how to shoot enough that I was going to be able to take care of business. I used to always say, if someone asked me, if they asked me in a polite and respectful manner, you know, is this real? And can you show me why or how or whatever? I would always say, if there was a ring there, and probably that night he's in the building with wrestling matches, there's a ring there. If it had been earlier in the night, he'd ask me, or after the matches, he had asked me, I would have said probably what I said to so many people when I got that question. I would say, I can show you more in 5 minutes than I can teach you in 5 years. And I would say, there's a ring there. Let's go to that ring, get yourself some boots. We're in an arena. There's lots of boots here. There's lots of different tights here. Borrow a pair of tights. We'll borrow you a pair of boots. We'll go up in the ring there and I will basically show you. Then when you do it that way, you don't really have to hurt them too badly. Because you've been very nice and you make sure they understand that you're going to get in the ring with somebody that, and you're going to find your answer that you're asking. And it's not a pleasant thing, but then you control yourself. Now, David, I think I don't know that he was expecting it. Maybe he heard Stossel ask somebody that question prior to him asking David that question. And David already had his mind made up. By gosh, if he says that to me, I'm going to pop him. And you know, I like to handle it in a much more calm manner. And sometimes you can actually convince people better if you do it in a calm manner than if you just lose total control and you go doing something crazy. I'd rather show someone what it feels like to have a hold put on them than to have their face slapped. Slapping the face is not a wrestling move. It's something far from wrestling. But I always wanted to use what the sport was all about. Like they say on the marquee, wrestling, you want to find out, is wrestling real? Then let's wrestle. And that's probably what I would have done. I would have handled it quite differently than what David did.
When it comes to the topic of exposing the business, did you have any rules in Southeastern You know, what about when baby faces wanted to hang out with heels? What about when they did hang out in a bar and you heard about it in the office? What were the rules that you had in terms of exposing the business, keeping kayfabe, and also in terms of dealing with the media? A situation like this, if the media comes around and you get that one reporter who says, I think it's fake, or I want to know if it's real, how do you deal with it?
I'll be honest with you. Gosh almighty, I guess I ran a good company. I ran a good business. I guess guys knew when they came to wrestle for me that how I treated the business and how I protected the business and that that's uncurt. You ain't going to get away with it. This is Ron's territory. And if you go, if you're seen in a nightclub with a, well, you're a heel and you're going to sit there and drink a beer in a nightclub with a baby face, you won't be here tomorrow morning. You know, I mean, I never had any leniency toward that. It was so vital and so important, in my opinion, for fans to be convinced that what we're doing is real. And boy, that's the easiest way to kill your business. And you just don't allow it. And I never did. I never really had to sit with people and talk to them, even tell them. I don't remember a single incident in which somebody was with another, a heel was with a baby face, and I ever had a wrestler tell me about it even. I think they just knew that this was the parameters of my leniency, that there is no leniency. When it comes to kayfabe, you either were 100% or you were in somebody else's territory and not mine.
Our final question this week is from Tommy Davis in Boise, Idaho. It sounds as if you endured a great deal of pain when you got the cauliflower ear. By my calculation, that was 47 years ago. Have you ever, or do you still have pain sometimes in that ear? Do you regret having not drained it so you wouldn't have a cauliflower ear now?
Oh, great question. Jeez. And it's kind of about last week's episode, too. Somebody's very interested in finding out more about it. I think I mentioned last week in the program that I wanted it. I mean, you could drain your ears, and that might be a year after year, a steady diet of that needle stuck in that earlobe and draining that blood out of it to keep you from having a cauliflower ear. A lot of guys did do it. I think about it after talking about it last week. You know, I got to thinking, I'm one of the few people in my generation of my family that has a cauliflower ear. Rob never got one. Jimmy never got one. The Roy and Jack never got one. The Fields brothers, they might have had cauliflower ears, but their sons, Ricky Fields, you had mentioned earlier, Ricky Fields did not have a cauliflower ear. I wanted it. And I just felt like that if I was going to be legitimate looking and legitimate in my sport and really give my all to it, that I wanted to look the part as well as us talking the part. And that ear just gives you that, it gives you something different than 99% of the population of the world who has a cauliflower ear. Basically, there's not many people that do, and when people see it, they kind of instantly identify it with boxing, wrestling, MMA, that type of activity. But I wanted it, and the second part of it, I never had pain. Once you get that ear cauliflowered, once you take that last blow and that cuts off the exit from your the upper part of your ear to the lower part of your ear from that blood, it dries in there. And once it dries, it gets as hard as a rock and you'll never have pain with it again. I never had any. So they say I've had some guys say, oh gosh, my ear, I couldn't hear good after I got my cauliflower ear, or I have earaches. I never had earache. I never had a problem ever after I got it finished putting that 3 months behind me of pain, of consistent, constant pain. I put that behind me after about 3 months, and that shot from Murdoch in the boxing match just put the little quietus to the end of it. Now, all of a sudden, I'm going to have a cauliflower ear. I never regretted it. I guess the other part of it, I never regretted it. I was always, I guess this is probably sounds kind of crazy in a way, but I guess that's why I was a wrestler, is I always was kind of proud of it. It was like a badge of courage in a way, you know, that those people that have them and that were able to stand that pain, it's something to be proud of. It is a trademark in a way of what you do in your life. And being a wrestler, you kind of need that cauliflower ear to be legitimate.
What did the hockey players think of your cauliflower ear?
Oh, they asked me about it a whole lot. You know, I mean, and the hockey players they're great, great guys, man. Those kids that play hockey, I admire those suckers, man. They do things that we as wrestlers don't do. And one of the things I really admired about them is they'd be out there in the first period and they'd get cut by a stick or they'd get in a fight and bust an eye, and they'd truck those boys back in the locker room and they sew them up and they're back on the ice in 15 minutes. They're right back out there in the battle again. You know, in wrestling days, you got your eye busted. You had to go get you sewed up afterward at the hospital somewhere. You found a hospital where you could get yourself sewn up. But I never missed any shows. A lot of guys would get their stitches and they would go, oh, I want to take off a week. You know, I'm afraid I'm going to bust my stitches. I had stitches, Jesus, hundreds in my head, and I never took a single night off. I didn't worry about what's going to happen to them the next night. You know, you just go and do your deal. It's like part of your job, and sometimes you get hurt on the job. You can't just quit, so you go back again and again. So, this wrestling is a tremendous sport. It's a phenomenal thing to get involved in. Back in those days, in my day, and in my dad's day and my grandfather's day, it was just... I was proud of it. I was always proud to be a wrestler. I never, ever thought that I was doing something that was belittling me. I always was proud to be there, and I always wanted to have my wrestlers just as proud. That's why I had my Tony Charles and my Les Thorntons and all kinds of the Dale Lewis's and all kinds of these shooter types that were there and around almost all the time, so that the other guys that were there could be molded in that same mold that I was trying to build my business around. And as far as guys not going out to heel and a baby face, wow. It was so taboo. Like I said, I never had anybody ever come to me and say, I saw so-and-so and so-and-so, because the guys just knew it. They knew that that was it. You do that here, and you're looking for someplace else to work.
With that, Ron, we wrap up another episode. I want to remind everyone, of course, on Facebook, you could go to the page that is Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, and like that page to keep up with the latest news with the Tennessee Stud. Of course, you could also follow him on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You could also hear me each week on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. TNstud.com is a place you can go and get access to every episode of the Studcast. You can also get access to the Super Studcast, and we want you to check out the gallery this week. If you haven't yet had enough of cauliflower ear talk, there's a photo there that Ron specifically wants everyone to look at. It's a bit much, but if you want to know what we're talking about with cauliflower ear, this is the pick, right, Ron?
Yeah. This is a good one. I mean, I saw this picture, and I was looking for, I tried to pick a picture that goes with every episode, and I was rummaging around on the internet, and I see this picture, and Oh, it made me grab my ear, just like, oh my gosh almighty, look at that. It was just like, it brought me back, you know. And you know, I'd like for fans, if you want to go on the TN Stud site and take a look at that gallery, and that gallery is just becoming a phenomenal thing now. It's just filling up with so many photos and so many wrestlers, and I'm proud of that, the gallery, and how it's developing through time here, and that's going to be one of my favorite pictures on that gallery, I can tell you that. When I look at it, it's like, well, it brings back some memories, not so good, but it certainly brings back memories for me.
We brought up the Super Studcast before. We want to tell you that Tuesday, July 17th is the next fantastic Super Studcast with two of the most famous wrestlers of all time. Also, names that were mentioned in the previous Super Studcast, of course, that's Super Studcast number 6, Japan 1983. The guests that I'm speaking of on the next Super Studcast, former NWA World Champion Terry Funk will be with us, and also with us will be Stan the Lariat Hansen. So don't miss the next Super Studcast, Terry Funk and Stan Hansen. Wow, that's a big one, Ron. That's a really big one right there. But on the topic of big shows, we have a really special one next week, don't we?
Yes, we do. You know, and just on that, those two guys there, just briefly before we go on to the next thing, I picked those guys. I handpicked those guys because they're involved. They're part of this, the episode 6 with the Tour of Japan in 1983. And I can't wait to interact with them and talk about that tour itself. Two great guys, two of the best of all time. Just really pleased and honored to have them be on the program on the Super Studcast number 7. And then next week, yeah, we're going to do something that really is unusual, I think, Brian, for our show. Since it's an anniversary, it's and I can't believe it. This is 52 weeks. I've been doing this for a year now. It seems like I'm 10 episodes in. I mean, I just really love this, and I just enjoy it so much. And so I thought, how can I really give fans something different? And I think I came up with something that, you know, we have, and our patrons are just fabulous. They're unbelievable. They support this entire thing, all these studcasts, the Super Studcast, as well as the regular studcast. And so many people are listening to the studcast that have never listened to a Super Studcast. I wanted to give them a little bit of an idea of what the deep dive is all about, what these programs, these Super Studcasts are all about, is, you know, getting really into the subject and learning about a person or a topic, whatever it may be. And next week, we're going to take about 6 from 6 Super Studcasts. We're going to take an 8 to 10 minute segment out of each one of them, so that fans that have never heard one of these are going to be able to hear. They're going to hear about Andre. They're going to hear about Ron Wright. They're going to hear the Caribbean, Crazy Caribbean. They're going to hear about my brother, Robert. They're going to hear about the Hall of Famer, Bob Armstrong. And they're going to also hear some of Japan of 1983. And I just think this will be a phenomenal program. And I would like to have everybody join us for that one and tell their friends about it. It's going to go a little longer than our usual studcast, because there's 6 different segments in there, I really, really think that fans are going to, this is going to be the talk of the studcast of all of them so far, that I really believe fans are just going to really, really enjoy these. And please tell your friends, if you are a studcast fan, that if you're going to listen to one next week's episode number 52, anniversary show, is going to be really phenomenal.
Ron Fuller Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. 1, 2, 3.
three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.